My name is Wizzy Brown.
And I'm Bryant McDowell.
And I'm Molly Keck.
And we're with the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service Department of Entomology, and this is Bugs by the Yard, where we hope to increase your enthusiasm about bugs in the urban landscape.
Welcome back to Bugs by the Yard. Today we've got a pretty exciting, at least I'm excited for this topic. I know everyone's excited. You've probably heard a lot in the media about this year's periodical cicadas that are emerging. So we're going to kind of cover cicadas in North America, the difference between annual and periodical cicadas. And before I get too excited and too ahead of myself in periodical cicadas, we'll go ahead and knock out our annual cicadas that we hear. If you're in Texas, you've been around in the summer, you know that you hear these intense loud screams for a good, what, 5-6 weeks of the year, I'm thinking.
July, August.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, usually it's like the end of June to August, I feel maybe. It might be pushed a little further back. And those species, they arrive every year. It's not special or anything. It's obviously a nice sight. I like them.
They are special in their own way.
They are special in their own way.
They tell us it's about to get really hot.
Yeah. That is kind of what they do, right? The heat is coming. So cicadas belong to the order Hemiptera. They're in the suborder Echinorhynchus. Their body shape is kind of tent-like, I guess. How would you all describe it? It's, I guess, tent shape kind of goes for that entire suborder.
Up tent, not fancy glamping tent.
Yeah.
With a pointy nose. They have like a A-shaped head.
Yeah, it is kind of A-shaped. And the eyes are very bulgy to the side, I feel.
They pop out instead of just part of the head.
Yeah. Size of adults in Texas, we have a pretty good range. I mean, I've seen some pretty small ones, but up to maybe like 2 inches as adults.
Yeah, usually the ones we get are larger.
I personally
am always excited when I find the smaller ones. I'm just like, they're so
adorable.
Cute.
Yeah, the first time I ever found a small one was in Dominica. And I thought, oh my gosh, like this island is so special. They have tiny little cicadas that were, I mean, less than an inch. They're so cute. And they are still loud, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, the size doesn't really dictate the amount of loudness.
Yeah, small but mighty. 3,000 species worldwide. They're found globally aside from Antarctica, from what I researched.
I always think of them as kind of being more tropical, but I guess that's not true because they're all over the United States, even far north. But are they in like in Europe and England and Russia where it gets really cold, or are they just in warmer pockets of those countries?
I think they stick to the same, what is it? The same latitude?
Longitude.
Correct? Yes.
Okay.
Because it's the same longitudinal,
long, right?
Yes. Oh my gosh. I should know that. You're right. Latitude is up because yes. Okay. The same longitude. So I don't think they go super far
south, like
Northern Europe area, but there are some like in the, Italy-ish area?
Would it really matter if it's hot or cold because they come out when it's warm? So it's, I don't know. I was thinking of winter time. Would that deter them? But they're not even out here when it's winter. They're in the ground where they're not getting frozen most likely.
Yeah. And I guess we'll circle back to that because there's hypotheses of why there's this extended period of time in the ground and all of that for the North Americans.
But that's for periodical, not the annual.
Right. So 55 species of annual cicada in Texas. Was that right, Wizzy?
Mm-hmm.
That's insane to me. 55 species.
And have you noticed that
Texas is a big state?
It is a big state.
That's very true.
I've never been able to look at two of them and really differentiate between two species unless it's like the tiny one and the big one. So they all must look very similar, but they all sound different. The different species have a different sound.
And for the most part in Texas, I guess unless you're in my area and you're going to get the periodical ones, they all kind of have, you're right, they kind of look the same. It's like a green, brown, white markings. Like the markings are different. They almost look like they're painted. I think that's why I like them.
Yeah, if you
a lot.
Look at them up close when they're fresh, like a lot of times you'll see them, find them dead, right? But when you find a fresh one, they're really ornate almost. Like they are very bright in color. When they die, they kind of just turn brown.
Yeah. R.I.P. Well, you know, it's my dream to get a shadow box coffee table, and I want to fill it with cicadas because I don't know why I've had this idea since 2014, and I'm gonna do it.
Just cicadas?
Cicadas, yeah, like a cicada shadow box. How fun would
Okay. I could think of other insects that I would prefer, but to
Okay,
each his own.
so I will say, and this was verified via multiple videos that I looked at for this podcast, but whenever we get into periodical cicadas, this is the like North American specialty. So like people from other countries, you know how we're
Really?
like, oh, we love the insects, like we find them fascinating and beautiful. Whereas people from other countries who don't have the periodical cicadas, that's like our specialty, right?
Really?
Like I had a foreign exchange student come to our summer camp last year, and there was a day where they had to do like a poetry, they made like a haiku, and it was really fun. They would get up and read it. And she made this beautiful poem about cicadas. I think she was from China, and it was all about like coming to America and hearing the cicadas song. As far as noticing cicadas, we notice them, as we mentioned, those kind of 5, 6 weeks. However, they are down in the ground completely unnoticed by us for the majority of the year. So I'm just going to talk about the regular annual cicadas. Whenever they emerge, hatch out of their eggs. So the eggs are laid in stems of trees. They will hatch out and they fall down to the ground. They burrow down. They're about the size of a grain of rice, I've seen them compared to. They'll fall down to the ground, burrow down, and that's where they spend the next year to 17 years, we're going to say, because we'll get into the periodical, feeding on the xylem of the tree roots. And from what I saw, from what I researched, they pretty much don't move around. They kind of stay in that area. Have you guys heard anything different from that? As nymphs,
No.
Yeah.
apparently they just kind of attach and they'll stick around. They're not like actively moving
Which would
around.
make more
So
sense because they must have an incredibly slow metabolism to not, you really don't, at least in Texas, don't hear about them causing damage to trees in the nymphal form. Maybe in the adult form, like if they lay eggs, they'll kind of groove into trees. But you would think, you know, as
yeah.
many as we hear in the summer, you'd think that there's numbers enough to cause some damage, but they don't.
Yeah, so they go through all their nymphal stages underground, and then once those temperatures rise, and I don't know if this is just for the periodical or if it's for annular as well, but there's kind of this emergence click that occurs. It's, from what I saw, anywhere from 64 to 65 degrees. When the soil temperature is 64 to 65 degrees, 8 inches of the topsoil. I've also seen that measurement in the 64, 65 range for 2 weeks. So I don't know if it's a time duration or if it's like the depth.
So then they're not going real deep. They're staying in the top 8 inches of the soil, presume, right?
So I am wondering that as well. I would assume so, because a lot of our, I'm trying to think of like primary host species, the roots aren't super deep of those
Well, also in
trees.
some parts of Texas, there is not 8 inches of topsoil. So
Yeah,
where I live, you're
yeah,
lucky if you got
that's true.
half an inch
Although,
sometimes before you hit solid rock.
limestone. Side note, that was the joke on us. We were putting in a retention wall at our old property, and when we went to dig, because it was like built into the side of a hill in Marble Falls, it's
Yeah.
all rock. So trying to dig
I
down
was like,
was
doing
impossible.
impossible. Yeah.
Yeah. So those adults basically are stimulated to come up out of that topsoil. They all emerge within this time span. They don't last too long. From the time the first one emerges to the time that you kind of hear the last one, it's within the summer months. They do all kind of come out at the same time. So we do kind of have, what's the term? Is it predator satiation? Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Kind of, which we see this with mayflies are a great example, but I could even probably say that for crane flies that we see now that I'm getting calls about, is like there's a benefit to emerging in a
Yeah.
mass because you're less likely to be predated on, essentially, or that's the hypothesis behind that. And you're more likely to find a mate, which is the whole purpose of their adult cycle. They come out of the topsoil. The males are making their lovely, beautiful noises, females will make a clicking noise to attract males. The male cicada have these special timbal organs behind the hind wing on the thorax. I believe that's correct. Is it on the abdomen? If you were to kind of put the wings out to the side, you would see these kind of two, in our species, are like a whitish membrane. And it's all exoskeleton, but they essentially will vibrate that in order to make their noise. I was also really interested in the difference. I wish we could insert the cicada song here, because
you can put some in the show notes, right?
I think we can. And I even was going to go as far as to make a playlist and then just kind of attach it, like a playlist for fun videos, because some videos touch on specific topics. So the individual male cicada itself, it's, I don't want to call it a chirping noise, but it's kind of, there's breaks. There's like a noise and a break and a noise and a break. But whenever I imagine the noise of cicadas in Texas, it's just this loud, constant screech. So essentially they all kind of join together and create this just like echoing loud screech. Another fun fact, so I mentioned that the females will make clicking noises. Apparently you can even, and I'm going to try this year, if you like make clicking noises, which I think people have reported it with like machinery they're using, landscaping machinery, and
thinking one of those like dog clicker trainer things.
I would imagine that would work too. So I found it might be like a David Attenborough video where there's a cicada on a stem. It's a male cicada, and he's demonstrating how, I'm going to post that one to the show notes for sure. So he's snapping his fingers, and this little cicada is literally following him as he's snapping. He's like, oh, let me see if I can get it to turn around. And he goes to the opposite side of the stick and starts snapping that way, and the cicada just turns around. So point of this story is, I'm thinking, if I want to catch a lot of male cicadas for my shadow box coffee table, I'm going to go outside with a dog clicker and see if I can't catch a bunch. I'm hopeful. Or I could travel to one of these areas with the periodical cicadas.
I think it's worth just pointing out, you said it, but you said it fast, that only the males make that kind of metallic buzzing, like a chainsaw. Some species sound like a chainsaw.
If I remember correctly, the song is like 100 decibels, which is
like up to like 120
motorcycle. Wow.
Yeah, if you've ever been like, in like a park or something, walking through a trail where it is really densely wooded, you know, like in your backyard, it can be pretty loud, but it's maybe not as dense. It's like deafening sometimes, where you can't even carry on a conversation.
Oh, I was also surprised at the numbers, which again, I think this goes more for I'll get into that in a minute, actually. Defensive mechanisms. I would have thought that loud noise would be kind of a deterrent for predators, but it seems like it's really not. One. Two, from what I gathered for our Texas, like typical annual species, they're a little better at avoiding predators, as in not as, what's the term I usually give to insects that are just like terrible, like clumsy flyers? Mm-hmm. They're almost lazy, right? Like they don't invest a lot in getting away from the predator or like flapping their wings. So I guess the Texas or like the annual species are a little better at that than like the periodical.
Probably because they've had more of a chance to work it out, right? Like, because they come out every single year instead of every 13 or 17 years. So they've had a chance every year they can pass on better genes to the next generation.
Like, we know what we're doing.
Yeah, we know what we're doing.
I also think they're really well camouflaged, a predator, but you know, in a tiny tree, I can hear tons of them. And I remember being a kid and climbing up in trees where they were making all that noise, and I couldn't find them, never could spot them. So they wherever they are, they're very well camouflaged.
I had a thought about that too. I'm like, well, maybe there has something to do with that, because our annual species are that kind of green and brown color, and maybe they're just better camouflaged. But then I look up species that are tropical, and I found these like insane vibrant colors of just beautiful blues. And I'm like, okay, well, my hypothesis.
But what are they hanging out on?
That's true. There could be, you know, specific plants or something that they're feeding on that are better, I don't know, camouflage for them. So they're different from kind of other insects in that they're feeding on the xylem. So there's xylem feeders and phloem feeders, and a lot of the like aphids and things like that are going to be phloem feeders, are going to produce that like honeydew because it's so sugary. Xylem is essentially just water and nutrients. And so that's what they're feeding on down under the ground for the entire year. For the periodical cicadas, either 13 or 17 years. I guess we can talk about pest status. I've always generally accepted that they're not a pest. People do worry, I think, about damage because the females have this kind of saw-like ovipositor. They're going to lay their eggs down. And I saw a couple images. It almost looks like pilot holes that are drilled, like in a line in some cases. It's pretty interesting.
Looks also a little bit like squirrel chewing to me, too.
Yeah, just like something, I don't know. There was that time that you had sent a photo, somebody had sent a photo of like a lace bark or maybe a crepe myrtle that has that bark peeling. And I thought, oh, it's just kids. Like that's just child damage that can, you miss the hooligans messing with the plant. If I was to come across those holes, I would have thought, oh, maybe it's man-made or something. Should we get into periodical cicadas now?
I think that's what everybody wants to know about.
Is it time?
That's the exciting story.
Yes.
They're like, oh yeah, we hear the cicadas every year, blah, blah, blah. We don't need to hear about them.
Every year. Yeah. So for the longest time, I, for some reason, had trouble comprehending periodical cicadas. And I think what would throw me off is broods. So a long time ago, let me double check my date really
In
quick.
In a galaxy far, far away.
Yes. I've got them right here. I say long time ago. It was 1907, so really it's not that far. But an entomologist, essentially, so Charles Marlett, assigned Roman numerals 1 to 30 for different broods of the periodical cicadas. So people were catching on, oh, okay, we see these periodical cicadas. The 30 comes from 13 plus 17. So the idea is like there's 17-year cicadas, there's 13-year cicadas. That was never confirmed or anything. So from what I found, I think it was like 15 or 17. 17 total broods were confirmed. Two of those have since gone extinct. So brood 11 and brood 21, from what I found, has gone extinct. And those were, it's interesting, actually, their ranges are very different. Brood 11 was much further north, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. Brood 21 was Florida Panhandle, which is interesting because you look at the maps of the broods now and there are none in Florida. So when we say brood, these are essentially pockets of, you know what, I guess I'm going to back up. I talked about 3,000 species of cicadas being described, 55 in Texas. There's one genus. This is the specialty, right? One genus of cicada in North America, Magicicada. Within that one species or genus, there's seven species of cicada that are periodical cicada. And those seven species can be broken down into different broods, which you can think of as just a group that emerges together in a specific area. There's a really neat map from USDA that I'll post in our show notes if you want to go and see. I guess it looks like a county map of verified records, but you can see how these pockets of individuals are all kind of geographically separated. There's not a lot of overlap within those populations.
But the broods, as I understand it, the brood is based upon when they emerge in the same location, but it can contain multiple species of cicadas. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I always get, I'm not sure. I'm glad you kind of clarified that because I never understood what the brood meant. Like, was it a specific species or, like you said, it's multiple species. It's just that year they all come out.
Right. In a given area.
I always thought that it was the species, kind of species specific because, and all this being said, just because let's say there's overlap of broods, different environmental factors can throw off this dead set, 13 or 17 year cycle. There's cases where I was looking into, like when we had that freeze in 2021, I think it was that year, essentially because the trees, right, in January were like, oh, spring is coming. They're kind of doing their thing, getting ready for the warmer months. We had a freeze in February and that triggered all of the, trees to drop their leaves, essentially stop growing. And then it warms up again in February. hypothesize that there's some sort of cue there to the cicadas that threw off the year count, essentially. So they ended up emerging a year early. It's insane. There's so many videos about it. You can go in and look. And it's not like the entire brood emerges. It's just like some pockets of them. There was still a mass emergence of that same brood. I think it was like, it wasn't brood 10. That was, I think, 2 years ago. The map that I'm going to post, USDA Forest Service map, has all the described broods and their next emergence dates. So this year is super special, 2024, because we've got brood 13, which is a 17-year cicada, and brood 13, is that right?
Oh, yeah, 13, sorry. Which is, no, wait.
Oh, and I think I said that wrong.
I think it's opposite. I think brood 19 is a 13-year and 13 is a 17-year.
Yeah. Brood 19 is a 13-year cicada, which is weird. And then brood 13 is a 17-year cicada brood.
Exactly. So now we can all see why this is so confusing to talk about, unless you have it like in front of your face and you're looking at the map. I always thought, you know, when I hear about these mass emergences, I just grouped it as like the eastern United States. I didn't realize that there were such, I'm not going to say small pockets. Some of these broods expand over like 15 different states. And so that's the cool thing about this emergence in 2024. Brood 19 spans, I think it's like 15 states, basically from the mid, I don't know what that would be considered. When I hear eastern US, I don't give it far enough western distance, if that makes sense. So if you literally take the US and you like draw a line down the middle, that's, I'm referring to this entire area. And then brood 13, which is a little further north, there's a little bit of overlap. And so I think that the people in those areas are the ones that are very excited about, you know, this mass emergence. The point is, many people over many states are going to see some sort of mass emergence of one of these broods. Even where they overlap, though, from what I was reading, there's not any sort of, you're not going to really be able to tell that you're approaching a new mm-hmm. brood. There's no sort of...
That's because if you have ever experienced a mass cicada emergence, there's just like cicadas everywhere. And you're just like, oh, yeah, it's another cicada.
And I'll post some of those videos too. It almost looks like they're faked. Like it almost looks like someone went and collected a bunch of cicadas and dumped a 55-gallon bucket like on the ground. And then, you know, you're watching them all kind of move along. Which, by the way, I do love seeing that like last instar that's coming up out of the ground. They look so weird. And I came across this in Baton Rouge one summer when I was working there. I had never seen that before. So to me, I was like, what is that? Like, it's the coolest thing. This instar before, we're so used to in Texas seeing that exoskeleton that's clinging to the sides of our houses, telephone poles, trees. You really only see the cicada whenever they're, I don't know, maybe on their way out, coming to lights. Do you ever see like pockets of a bunch of cicadas here in Texas? I don't.
What we have here in Texas is nothing like this. I mean, because I grew up in the Midwest and we dealt with this. And I mean, it's just, there's.
It's... What brood were, what area?
Ohio. So I have no idea what brood that is. But dang, I mean,
brood X.
There we go. Brood X.
Yeah,
but I was up there last time it emerged. I was visiting my family and I caught the tail of an end of it. And it's just like you're walking over cicadas that are crawling on the ground. Yeah. And there's just holes. You want to talk about it? Looks like somebody went through like a soil aerator and just took those chunks out of the ground from where everything was emerging. And definitely you mentioned with our trees that there wasn't damage, but you could literally see the tree branches and damaged because when they would lay their eggs in it, those branches were damaged and they were kind of down and they were starting to turn brown. And
oh, wow,
it was just fascinating. I mean, it was great. And I got a great video of, it was a great example of the the nervous system of an insect and how they don't have the brain or whatever, you know, they have the ganglia. There we go.
Yeah.
I'm like, what the heck is that name? But it's just like this cicada is like walking along the ground and it only has the head and thorax. The abdomen was completely gone and eaten by something, and still it was going? Just still trucking along.
So they're pretty beefy. Like, when they die, is it really stinky as they all start to die off, or do they get eaten?
They usually get eaten, but I mean, it's
they're not like piled up dead.
No, I mean, I would just say it'd be kind of like a thin layer of mulch.
Okay.
The images mulch. That I've seen looked like that, but it also looked like they were just the shed exoskeleton. So I couldn't tell if it was like the end of the season, because this too, by the end of the season, those that have successfully reproduced, they look beat up. Like, they look rough. And I didn't even describe what these look like. So the periodical cicadas, this genus is like the very black cicada red. With these amazing red eyes.
They kind of look evil.
So in Texas, do I?
They kind of look evil.
They do look a little evil.
They got those beady red eyes. I mean, they're just like...
Yeah, red eyes in general. That screams evil, I feel. Oh, and they scream. So, I mean, it all works out. There's so much to unpack here. So as far as the 17 or 13 year cycle, do we want to talk about hypotheses for that at all? Why 13 and 17?
So yes, but first, just so everybody has it, the last time these two broods emerged together was 1803. And the next time they will emerge together is 2245.
Golly. So this is history.
This is history. And those numbers, what is that? 200 and what is 17 times 13? That's where we're getting these annual numbers. I think it's like 230 something. 221. Got it. Every 221 years. So there's a couple hypotheses as to why there's the 13 and 17 year longevity. And the one that I've really come across is that predator avoidance theory. So predators have like their own cycle, right? If it's a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year. And the idea behind having like the 13 or 17 year cycle, this is so much easier to describe whenever you're looking at the image. But it's much harder for a predator to sync up with that prime number 13 or 17. So what I mean by that is, let's say I emerge every 6 years. If there was a predator cycle of 1 year, okay, every sixth year, right, that predator is going to still be available for my emergence. Or if it was a 2 year predator population, we're talking about population densities right now, it would take 3 years to sync with that 6 year cicada, and so on. And so by having 13 years, you're kind of avoiding predators for that long. Therefore, they're not able to sync with your cycle / decimate the population, essentially. 13 and 17, just those are the prime numbers that work out from what I was reading. I will post a video specifically about this topic that does have, it kind of shows this in like a timeline. It's much easier to understand it. I'm not doing it justice. It's really fascinating, but it's much easier to understand that way. So I'll make sure that I post it. Make sure that you check that out. And then I guess I also wanted to mention 17 year. So when we're talking about like the Eastern US and these brood pockets, typically the 17 year broods are kind of northern in distribution, and then the 13 years are a little further south. There is some crossover there. So like the furthest north of the 13 year cicadas approach that kind of southernmost 17 year pocket. And hopefully I can find an image that kind of separates all of those for people as well. We talked about annual cicadas being down in the soil and having these environmental cues when things are warming up. And so the idea behind the why spend 13 or 17 years in the ground kind of goes back to, from this hypothesis, the last ice age. And so when the environmental factors, right, were not favorable above ground, essentially, this was kind of keeping a lot of these populations down in the soil. So this overlap of the 13 and 17 year cicada, I know that I've come across people asking, well, what if they like hybridize? It seems to be genetic, the 13 or 17 years. If hybridization occurs, those offspring are probably not going to sync with the 13 or 17 years. So if they, let's say, just for giggles, let's say they hatch in 10 years in that specific area, they're not emerging in these like insane mass numbers. And so they're much easier targets for predators, and they're less likely to find a mate and pass on those genetics. So this mass emergence has benefits in that you're avoiding predators, you're increasing the likelihood of finding mates, get the job done, reproduce, hatch out, go back to the ground where you're protected for another 13 or 17 years.
How do they survive for that long period? I mean, they're underground for a really long time.
It is underground for a really long time. And I also don't know that it's been super, like, really intensely studied. So from what I understand, it's all driven by these environmental cues. I do want to talk about, Wizzy, you mentioned seeing the individual with just like head thorax walking around and no abdomen. Was it caused by predation, or by any chance was there like fungus? Did you see the fungus? Can we talk about the fungus?
Oh, no, that one didn't have the fungus. No, that one was munched on by, I don't know, bird, snake.
Okay.
Another bug.
Well, I was
That is a benefit of these, by the way. I mean, this whole like a mass emergence, just think about all the food that is coming for birds and reptiles and mammals and all of that stuff. So there is a good side to this. And you get the free aeration done to your soil if you have them emerging out. So and when they die, you can have that compost. So look at the
cycle of life.
That stinky compost. And so that also kind of relates to the predator avoidance theory, because I know that there's studies of predators of cicadas, and of those years, right, like I mentioned, the population of predators are going to increase and decrease over a set period of time. So scientists have actually looked at, there's like a species of bird, for example. I think there's other general examples, but I know that the research was done on the birds, where the year before this big emergence, or the year of the big emergence, is when there's a large decline in the predator population. And it's like, how do they know? Basically, the birds have gone, right, 13 or 17 years without this promise of a huge explosion of food. Once that emergence happens, it's okay if there's a mass die-off due to predation, because there are billions of these insects. You know, estimates that I saw were like 1.5 million per acre, which to me is insane. I also saw a comparison to a football field, as many as like 5,000 emergences per football field. Take both of those with a grain of salt. I don't know who's going out and surveying, but essentially you get like a decline in these predator populations right before you have a large emergence. And then once this emergence happens, yes, it's great. It's bountiful. It feeds all these predators, and their numbers increase, only to go through these fluctuations for another 13 to 17 years, eventually kind of dropping off, which is also super interesting.
It would be interesting if someone would do like a study on the correlation with when there's these brood emergences, is the population of birds greater that next spring? It couldn't be.
Oh, that would be interesting. Like, is there like a greater survival because there's more food availability?
I mean, I'm like,
that's what I was understanding.
Logically, you would think that would be the case, but you know, the way science is, you have to prove it to be able to say it, but it would be interesting to for someone to just look at multiple different types of animals. Like how does their population increase in relation to the cicadas? Sorry. And then it can't be immediate, right? They're feeding their offspring, they're feeding themselves, they're producing eggs. So is it something that you would see 6 months or a year later? Like it's a delayed gratification kind of.
And from what I've seen, how it's described, the predators are just like overwhelmed, like to the point where they have consumed so much.
Bored with
like,
it.
If I eat another cicada, I'm gonna
sick of
like,
it.
I need some
diversity in my diet.
Yeah, exactly. From arthropods to, I've seen like squirrels and possums and turtles, or maybe it's tortoises. I don't know.
Both.
Birds, just everything. So I do want to talk about the fungus that I mentioned earlier. So there is a, and I don't know if it's actually called this, but I saw it referred to as the cicada STD. And that I took it and I ran because I'm like, this is perfect. But there's a fungus. There's these spores essentially are all over the soil. They can survive in the environment for extended periods of time. And so once you get like a mass emergence in an area, I believe it's typically the males that are going to be kind of first exposed. What happens is it kind of changes the behavior of the male. So we talked about this song that the males produce. They will continue to make that song and attract females to them. But they also, their behavior changes in that they'll mimic the clicking noises of females of that species. And so it actually draws in other males. And so anytime an individual comes into contact with an individual that's been infected with this fungus and they're exposed to it, the fungus essentially spreads this way via the promise of copulation between males or females. But very interesting. Like, I don't know that it has a huge negative impact on the population, again, because there are so many in the area. Essentially, is that the fungus is like eating the cicada from the inside out. And whenever you do come across one that's right before death, it's like the abdomen is gone and you've just got these like fungal pockets kind of coming out of the thorax. So I was interested to know if you had seen that, Wizzy.
I have seen that, yes. And that, just so people don't panic, that fungus, it's only going to infect the periodical cicadas.
Oh, yes, it is specific. Yeah, you don't want to worry people about a fungal STD.
Yeah.
A zombie fungus.
I know people get upset about possibly other things getting infected by stuff.
Massospora cicadina is the fungus, by the way. Did you ask how they survive under the ground? So I mentioned xylem, and I know unable to obtain all of the amino acids. So I remember reading about these like endosymbionts. And so many insects will have organisms within their gut that aid, you know, when they're not, maybe if they're feeding on a very specific food source. My number one go-to is termites, how they are digesting cellulose with those endosymbiotic bacteria and something else. I want to say it's escaping me. So by having these endosymbionts, they're able to provide those amino acids necessary for growth and development for the cicadas. We're talking about all this predator consumption. And another thing that I totally skipped on is the use of cicadas. Humans will go out and gather a bunch of them. I have a friend who lives, I don't know where, but there was a large emergence like 2 or 3 years ago. It might've been Brutex. Went out and was making pad thai with cicadas and whatnot, which to me, it just seems like it would be very, very crunchy, almost like eating a popcorn, like just the shell of the popcorn, not even enjoying the actual kernel. I don't know. You know, Molly knows I've got an issue with crunchy things. So now that I'm thinking about it, this is just like a nightmare for me. And maybe I don't
move on, right?
Is it? Yeah.
If you want to see them this year, probably the biggest states are Illinois and Missouri for predictive populations of emergence. And Illinois has both of the broods of cicadas with some overlap in there. So I think that the emergence is supposed to start in April and go through July. But it's going to, you know, it's kind of like when our cicadas emerge here in Texas, you know, they begin late June and go through August. So it's not everybody coming out all at once because I think the adults only live like 4 to 6 weeks, right?
That's what I saw, 4 to 6 weeks. I'm really interested to know if the pockets between, like the map that we're looking at right now for brood locality, if those pockets are due to under like surveying or if it's, like, I want to know why that spatial divide is there. Is it the mountains that are occurring there that are...
Yeah. What, the Appalachian? Like,
yeah, for brood 19. So you mentioned like Missouri and Illinois. And like, if you look at those, like it's like the whole state, right? Verified record from the whole state. And I think North Arkansas. But then as you move further east, you get these like very widespread, like, you know, all the counties are not like touching. They're kind of scattered, but it's still another, what, 8 states or something. So I'm interested to know more on that. It's also with Brood X, you kind of see some in like the like your area, Lizzie, like the Ohio region, and then they're kind of pushed over toward like Pennsylvania and
Well, the mountain range, if you think about the Appalachia over there, the Blue Ridge Mountains, those are going to be kind of going down through Pennsylvania, West Virginia, the western part of Virginia. So it's kind of like that right-hand side, but it doesn't explain that like big chunk missing in like
like through
western
Tennessee.
Tennessee or
Yeah, that's what I'm like,
Kentucky. I don't know what's going on there. Well, maybe there is. No, that's no. Yeah, I don't know.
We need a top, a like a topographical map, thing of topography overlaid on this brood map.
I know, I really want like an interactive map where I can take out broods and just focus
Yeah.
on like emergence years, and I'm sure it exists somewhere. Someone's got to
And
do that.
I wonder if you look at that map, it's funny because there's like gaps, right, in counties. And I'm sure that map probably is fairly old. It doesn't seem like it's like great graphics, right? And I'm sure those spaces have probably filled in, and those have like, and the cicadas have crossed over counties as they've flown. So I imagine that it's maybe more, it's larger than we realize.
Do y'all know what, if any, species of tree that are preferred, if there's like a preferred host or anything, or I've never come
That's a good
across that.
question. I don't know.
If they just say the tree. So
I don't know.
I wonder if they just accept like, oh, they're kind of a generalist on the plant, whatever it is.
That's what I would guess, just because we've never heard anything different.
Which is so interesting for it. I mean, for of all things to be general about, like they have a very specific life cycle, but
Not what they eat.
feeding is widespread. All right. So hopefully we answered all of your questions or curiosities about the periodical cicadas, and maybe you learned a little bit about our annual cicadas here in Texas. If you have any other questions, you can always reach out to us. Be sure to stay tuned. Next week, we'll be talking about, I say next week, next episode, we'll be talking about best beetles and pissalids. So for those of you in Eastern Texas, these kind of larger 1 to 2 inch beetles that have the most adorable chirping noises. Very, very fun species. So we will catch you next time. Howdy to our listeners and fellow bug nerds. We want to take the time to tell you to check out our show notes on each episode and for more information and supplemental materials on the topics covered. Additionally, if you have any questions or recommendations for what you may want to learn more about, you can send us an email to www.bugsbytheyard@gmail.com. If you enjoy this content and would like to learn more about structural pests that may invade your home, check out our other podcast, Unwanted Guests, brought to you by Texas A&M University AgriLife Extension and the Department of Entomology. As always, please subscribe or follow the podcast feed to make sure you never miss an episode.